is like some weird kids game where you're all like way over there. If anyone wants to move up, or if it's just hinky for me. Okay, so I thought I would talk about the new media and the media in general and how it's changing and affecting the court and how the court is, insofar as it's changing to accommodate the new media, how the court is kind of pushing back. And I want to, I'm going to talk for, I think maybe about a half hour, about sort of my perception of what's going on with the court and the press. And then I'm really happy to take questions about this or anything else. And my hecklers are here. Outstanding. Okay. But I thought I would talk, I would start by sort of saying what I've noticed in the, I guess I've been covering the Supreme Court for 13 years. And that still makes me, strangely, one of the youngest reporters on the beat, because there are people who've been covering it for 30 and 40 years. This is a beat that nobody leaves. Once you get to be on the Supreme Court beat, you stay forever and ever. And it's like being a justice. They carry you out, you know, sort of toes first. But nobody ever happily walks away from this job. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how the court has really had to torque itself around to accommodate changes in the media in the last 10, 15 years, how that's kind of changed how we perceive the court, but I think more interestingly, and where I want to get to in this talk and get your thoughts about it, is how the court perceives us. And by us, I don't just mean the media. I think how the court perceives the American public as expressed through the media. Because I think what I want to suggest to you is the court is terribly, terribly anxious about the media, the intrusion of the media, the ways that the new media have fundamentally changed the nine justices' sense of themselves in the world, and to at least think about whether that's starting to inflect on the court's doctrine. So let's start from the beginning, which is, I think we can stipulate that the court has a deep, deep anxiety about how it is perceived, right? It has no purse, no sword, no ability other than a teeny little press office to influence public opinion. And as long ago as Chief Justice John Marshall, the court was saying things like, here's Justice Marshall talking, the court lacks a legitimate means of ingratiating itself with the people. So it is a longstanding anxiety at the court that the American people don't get it, don't understand what it's doing, and that they don't have a mechanism to tell us what they're doing. And for a very long time, the court actually paid to have opinions printed because there wasn't an external mechanism to do that. And the court thought it was kind of good PR for them to pay independently for people to know what they were doing. So what I want to say is that the court pretty much entirely, and you can fight about the polling, but it rests on the public perception that it's basically doing good work, that it's basically independent, that it basically cares first and foremost about the law and only sort of secondarily about politics. And all these pillars of trust are the one thing that the court has to foster in the American public. And what I want to suggest to you today is that that's on a collision course with the media, particularly the media as it's constituted today. So the media today brings with it some of the best of the old notions of what the media did, right? Discomforting the comfortable and throwing open private institutions for public inspection and doing all the good work of shining sunlight on that which is inscrutable and unknowable, and that's important. But at the worst, I think we could agree that the new media is also a bunch of gossips who are looking for a good story. And I think that that is by definition starting to inform the way the court is covered. And I think both the court and the media are under unbelievable pressure now, in a way they have not been, each of them to be more of what they are. In other words, for the court to be more decorous, more gravitas-y, if that's a word, more divorced from politics and less swayed by public opinion. So there's that pressure on the one hand. On the other hand, I think the media has unbelievable pressure on it to act more quickly, to be more gossipy, to drill down deeper, to find a scoop, to not check, to report anonymously, to do all the things that make the court completely insane. So if we can posit that these two entities that have always been in tension are now really, really, really in tension in ways that we didn't used to see in this country, that's where I want to start from. So I think that for a very, very long time, the court was covered with some reverence in this country. That ebbed and flowed. We had, you know, historically, justices who palled around with reporters. We had William O. Douglas would just dish on the justices he hated to reporters, and that would get reported. So it's certainly not the case that the court has always been held at hand's length by the press. But I think it's certainly the case that generally the press has been pretty responsible and fair to the court and the court's agenda of being sort of mystified and rarefied. And all that really changes in the 1960s with the advent of what's called the new journalism, right? This is Bernstein and Woodward. This is Watergate. This is The Brethren, right? The Brethren is the first book about the court that is just gossip. Just gossip. Just the justices just telling what they think. And America goes crazy, right? America thinks, wow, we get it. And this is what we expect of our journalists. But of course, The Brethren does some damage, because what it reports is a story of a court that is almost completely political, almost completely ideological, and the horse trading and the deal making that goes on. And I assure you that every editor in America thinks that their Supreme Court reporter could write The Brethren, but chooses not to. So all of our editors think that we have amazing access to the clerks, and all this gossip is just lurking there waiting to be unfurled, and why can't we just report it out the way Woodward and Bernstein did? So that's the expectation. It has fundamentally changed what people want to hear and read about the court, for good and for bad. Okay, so this brings us to how I do my job. I'm going to go get my water. You all just study for test. So how I do my job has changed so profoundly in 12 years that I can't even begin to tell you. When I first started covering the court, I would go to argument at 10 in the morning, I would leave at 11, and then all the rest of the reporters would have lunch and talk, and they'd compare notes, right, because we didn't have a transcript. We had no way of knowing what had happened at argument because you're allowed to enter with one pen and one pad. And heaven forbid you try to take a newspaper into the press gallery at the Supreme Court, they will confiscate it. They will also confiscate, as once happened to me, your copy of Kafka's The Trial that you brought in just to read in the 15 minutes before argument. And when you talk about irony with the marshals, it goes poorly for you. So you can bring in a pen and a pad. And for the longest time, we would have to compare notes. Who said that? Was that Scalia? Was it Kennedy? I don't know. Was it Stevens? I don't know. That's what we did for an hour or two. And then most reporters had until about 4 or 5 to file their story that would go in the next morning's paper. And now, obviously, every single one of us needs to have a story up at the most 2 hours after argument. And even if it's wrong, it has to be up. And if we can do something really awesome, like a video or some audio, or, you know, find some guy in line and interview them, something that's going to go viral, that's what really, really what they want us to do. So the days of carefully thinking through what just happened in argument, is what's important, what was said, what are the big themes here, those are over. Now we report it out and it's up. And it's, you know, and then all of our mistakes get corrected over the course of the day. But there's also been a change, which is really the advent of citizen journalism. And what that means is, at the very high end of the spectrum, you have law professors who are blogging, right? Rick Hassin, Doug Berman, Eugene Volokh. They're covering Supreme Court oral argument from California and from Ohio, and they're doing as good a job covering it out in the world as we are in there in chambers. In fact, usually they're doing a better job because they wrote the treatise on this subject. And so you've got a whole bunch of reporters, Supreme Court reporters, who are incredibly anxious. How do I add value in an era when the transcript that gets thrown up by noon and by 2, the greatest thinkers in the world on this subject have already weighed in? So that's creating an enormous amount of stress on the part of reporters who feel like they really can't possibly say anything more important than the scholars who've written the book. But in addition to what I would say professional citizen journalism, there's also just the guy with his phone who is there at a speech when Justice Scalia is talking or when Justice Ginsburg is talking, and they are also journalists. And so we at the Supreme Court are missing the story at both ends, or have a sense of missing the story at both ends. We're not sufficiently sophisticated legal watchers and thinkers to really be able to do what the professor blogs are doing. But we're actually not running around with our phones going to speeches either. So we're sort of in the middle, confounded. And our editors are yelling at us all the time. How come you didn't get the speech of Justice Alito at the partisan political event? How come someone else got it? I didn't know. I wasn't there. They don't tell us their speeches. So we're missing both stories. And we're getting very, very anxious. And this is our life. So in addition to all this, there's just huge changes in the media that you all know. We can't make money. We are firing reporters everywhere. The press corps has shrunk significantly. What was a fairly substantial press corps when I started 15 years ago is now down to about 20, 25 reporters, most of whom no longer just cover the court, by the way. Most of them cover all of the Justice Department, judicial confirmation hearings, everything else. So the press corps is shrinking. You have an enormous amount of expertise that existed 15 years ago, 20 years ago, people who only covered the court, and that's what they did. And now you have less and less and less of that. So again, a sense that there's only a handful of us doing this because people really, really want to go to HuffPo and see the slideshows about, actresses without their makeup. And so we cannot create a demand for what we do, and that is also producing huge anxiety. Okay. So despite all of this, I'm going to submit to you that we are still an incredibly deferential press corps, perhaps the most deferential press corps covering any branch of government in this country. And it's kind of crazy when you think about it. The real breaking stories, the good, gossipy, dishy stories about the Supreme Court rarely come from folks inside the U.S., the permanent press corps. Who breaks those stories? David Margalek breaks them. Jeff Toobin breaks them. People who don't cover the court, sometimes Jeff Rosen will break one. These are not people who are coming to the court week after week after week. So again, there's a really strange permanent press corps that feels like its job is to report on oral argument and report on decisions. And then another entity that kind of once in a while comes to court, but more or less they're the ones doing the hard-hitting political reporting about the court. It's an interesting problem. I think they feel like they don't need access to the justices, so they can afford to say what they want. Those of us who are there week after week feel like we need access, so we're not going to do anything to jeopardize that relationship. So again, we have these tiers of all the things that are making us not fully do the jobs that we're doing. The best example I can give you of this is Toni Morrow, who years ago wrote a piece about the completely lack of minority clerks at the court, how the courts were overwhelmingly white males. And not only did nobody on the press corps back him up, but other members of the permanent press corps went out of their way to say, this is not a story. This does not befit a Supreme Court reporter to report a story like this. It's a political story, it's a partisan story, and it's inappropriate for us to talk about things like that. Same thing happened a few years ago when Ginni Thomas, you may remember for reasons that nobody knows, called Anita Hill early one morning. And we all got calls, everyone on the press corps, can you come on our morning shows and talk about, did Ginni Thomas get bonked in the head? Why was she doing that? And each of us, with very few exceptions, said, this is not a court story. Not a court story. This is talk to your political reporters. And I always notice that when a confirmation hearing comes up, and it might be kind of useful to have a Supreme Court reporter in there, they pull us off those stories and put their congressional reporters on. Because confirmation stories are fundamentally political stories, and there's really no place for those of us who just read and don't really know how to do anything but read, or that's the perception, there's no place for us there. So I just want to be clear. This is how I do my job in 2013. I walk into the court with a pen and a paper. And there's no access to audio, and there's no access to video, and I can't take in a recorder. And I try my best to transcribe very, very quickly and to make as few mistakes as possible. And the incredibly generous way that the court chose to meet us halfway was that they now give us a transcript that says what happened that day at about 3:00. So that's new. For the longest time, they didn't release transcripts. And then for the longest time before that, the transcript didn't say which justice was speaking. So when a question was asked, it didn't say Ginsburg, Thomas. It never said Thomas. It didn't say Ginsburg. But what it said was the court. So having a transcript was utterly useless, right? Because you never knew who was asking a question. But now you get a late transcript, and that's awesome. It means that we make a lot fewer mistakes. But it also means that we are doing our job with our hand and our foot tied behind our back for no discernible reason, right? The handful of times that the court has done same-day audio, and I've been able to link to audio, it's been just tremendous for people to listen in. Oh my God, really? That's what John Roberts sounds like? I had no idea. But we're not allowed to do it. And I'm going to talk about the audio policy in a minute. But really, where it makes a huge difference, and this goes without saying almost, is on decision days, when decisions come down and we make huge, colossal mistakes. So the most noteworthy is the ACA decision that comes down and gets misreported by not one but two major networks, and gets kind of misreported by most of the rest of us until we can read through it. Now, there are solutions for this, right? There are solutions for getting decisions wrong. One is to let you know what decision is coming down what day. No real reason for the court to be mystified about that. And what the Canadian Supreme Court does, which is fairly straightforward, and other courts do it, is to just have something called a lockup, where you give the reporters 3 hours with the opinion, you take away their BlackBerry, you cut off their arms, I guess, and you say, read the opinion. And here, if you need us, is a court resource who will help you understand the opinion. And then report it, but get it right, so that at 10 o'clock when we release the opinion, you're not just making stuff up. And that works, but the court won't do it. Okay. So this brings us to what I think is the really interesting part, which is I think the court is freaking out. Because the court doesn't like it when we get things wrong. And the court doesn't like it when we gossip. And the court doesn't like it when we report half of what's in one head note as the holding. But that's, we have to do that. We have no choice. And it is what it is. And there's a sort of a famous story of Linda Greenhouse going to then Chief Justice Rehnquist and saying, oh my God, stop it. Stop doing this thing. She could say things like that because she was Linda Greenhouse. The rest of us don't say stop it. But she just went to him and said, on behalf of the press corps, please do not spend the last 3 weeks in June handing down 3 and 4 major 80-page decisions in a day. The press can't digest it and report it and also get it right. And Rehnquist's response was, well, why don't you just report one on one day, and then tomorrow you could report the next one. And then you wouldn't get anything wrong. And Linda was like, thank you. Enormously helpful, and we moved on. So as opinions get longer and more abstract and you have 72 concurrences to wade through, the problem has gotten much, much worse. And as a result, things don't get reported. So what do I think is the best evidence I have that the court does not know how to deal with us and our needs? They have a sense that the Rehnquist solution, you know, just hold off on some of it and do that tomorrow. That's probably not realistic. They have a deep sense that we're reporting things that are trivial and wrong, and that's quite worrisome for all the gravitas-y reasons I talked about at the beginning. So what are they doing? How are they managing the needs of the reporters who really do, I think, in good faith, want to try to get it right? Well, so I want to look at their audio policy, which I think is just the most schizophrenic and deranged performance art I've ever seen. And this is, for years and years, the court releases no audio. They save it up, right? We know it's there. They're audio taping oral argument. But they don't release it. And then after Bush v. Gore, the court, in the person of Chief Justice Rehnquist, thought this is a matter of tremendous public importance and significance. People probably want to listen in. And so they release the same day audio of Bush v. Gore. And America actually does listen in and actually does learn something. And I think even though it was Bush v. Gore, probably came away saying, huh, they don't just flip a coin in there. That's useful. And we move on to the court making a decision for several years that on big ticket days, right, the high profile cases, they're going to release audio the same day. So you can sit and listen on NPR to the court going through oral argument. And again, people listen. Now, the downside to this, almost obvious, is that they're doing it on abortion, affirmative action, gun rights, and the other cases where the justices tend to be 5-4, hyper-partisan, apt to be very overheated. So they're sort of saying, let's throw open the doors to America and let them listen in on the days that we are the most badly behaved that we can be. And America responds by saying, wow, really interesting. Every court case of the United States is about guns and race and abortion, and look at them screaming at each other. So it's clearly a stupid policy. I mean, A, pity the guy who comes before the gun case, right? The guy who's like, sorry, your audio doesn't get released because you're actually not that consequential, which is never, I think, a message the U.S. Supreme Court should send to any party in a suit. But more to the point, I think the court is really saying, why don't you see us when we're 5-4, which is exactly the message, I think, that they don't want to be sending. So Chief Justice Roberts thinks about it and thinks about it and goes for a little while saying, okay, we're shutting all the audio down. Nobody can hear audio. That's it. And morons like me write pieces saying this is crazy, have a policy, be consistent. Best to have a policy that reflects the fact that most decisions are, you know, 9-0 and 8-1 and 7-2 and not all 5-4. And the Chief Justice goes, you know, you guys are right. Let's release all of the audio for the week at 5 o'clock on Friday, where news goes to die. And that's what they do. That's the policy. The policy is that at 5 o'clock on Friday, for those of us who are, say, writing our article from last Monday, we can go back and have audio links. So it's completely the most profound piece of jujitsu I've ever seen, where he's like, look, I'm giving it to you all, and I'm being completely democratic. It's just utterly useless to any of you who are daily news reporters. And I think that's really emblematic of how the court is trying to sort of accommodate us, but also really protect themselves. So here's where we get to what I think, and this is really me spitballing now, but what I think, as opposed to before when I was spitballing, but I think that what's becoming more and more interesting to me is the sense that I get that at least some members of the court are feeling really assailed and assaulted by the new media. So what do I mean? So think back to Justice Alito, who is snapped giving a speech to a partisan group. And his response is, to the reporter who took it, to the citizen journalist, this isn't news. Why are you reporting this, right? Or Clarence Thomas, who comes here to UVA to speak a couple of years ago, gives what is an explicitly closed door, no press policy that is immediately reported verbatim in Politico the next day because someone was taking notes and just leaked it. So I think that the justices feel like they can continue to enforce this rule that is, we go give speeches and they're off the record, but nobody honors that anymore. There's no such thing as off the record, and there's no such thing as private spaces anymore. And I think most of us understand that to be true, but the justices are really struggling with it. And so then I think you get language in cases that are about the new media, the internet, television, screens, that reflects a really deep anxiety on the part of some of the justices that the new media represents a sort of complete intrusion into the privacy of individuals. The new media utterly disrespects nuance and detail and goes for salacious reporting. And I'm just thinking of a line of cases, I won't belabor it now, but I'm thinking of a line of cases that starts when the court It starts actually in the dissent in Citizens United, where there's some talk about Clarence Thomas talking about the disclosure rules and how being forced to disclose who you donate to can result in harassment and reprisal. And then you see it in when the court decides to unplug the Prop 8 case, right? So the Prop 8 case is set to be televised in California. Alex Kaczynski at the Ninth Circuit says, hey, we have this pilot project. This is a case of unbelievable public importance. Let's roll in the cameras and see what happens. And the court just shuts it down. And it shuts it down with a lot of the same language of, look, witnesses are not going to want to testify. There has been acts of, again, violence and reprisals over Prop 8. Best to just televise unimportant things, says the court, because, you know, we don't want to televise things that get people all hepped up. And again, the language of, to be in the public sphere, to be televised, and in this case there was talk of streaming on the web, is to allow people to be open to violence and abuse. And then we see it again in Doe v. Reed, which is the Washington State case that again has to do with publicizing names of folks who are signing ballot initiative, in this case to try to undo Wisconsin's all but marriage statute. So in each of these cases, we see language from the justices that sort of says that the internet is a place for violence, for coarseness. There's talk from both Justice Alito and Clarence Thomas suggesting that in this era, where you can pull up someone's name, know that they signed a ballot initiative, and then cross-reference it with their property taxes, where their kids go to school, where they work, you can wreck lives. And this feeling of anxiety, I think, starts to really, I think, filter into the way they then start to talk in the violent video games case, in the Phelps case about funeral protests. There's some sense that the internet is different and cameras are different, and we don't exactly know how. We know that Justice Breyer, I think, would have looked very differently at Phelps if he could have gotten the court to focus only on the internet piece of that case. I think that's what Breyer was worried about, was throwing up things on the internet and violating people's privacy on the internet. But I do think that there are several justices at the court now who really do think that the internet is different and the new media is different and cameras are different. And I think they're not wrong. I mean, we know that, right? We know that the ability to target people, to organize boycotts, to end people's businesses because we can find them on the internet clearly exists. The question is, where is that going to go? And I think I just want to also say that in my view, it's not an accident that the two justices who feel most strongly that the news has changed and the media has changed, and that there's a real possibility of the media being used for reprisals and violence, are the two justices who really feel that they had the roughest ride at their confirmation hearings. And that is Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito. And I think they feel that in an age where the media was used to really destroy their reputations, and I don't think this is disputable. I think both Thomas and Alito feel that, rightly or wrongly, but I think they feel that. I think it starts to leach into the way they write about those forms of media when they're in fact writing. So I think I want to end my part of this by just saying, in my view, the court absolutely cannot have it both ways. In other words, if you want to be seen as serious and decorous and above politics and non-ideological, you have to conduct yourself that way. You cannot say, I'm going to be partisan and ideological, I'm just going to do it and hope nobody finds out. That's clearly not going to work, I think, in this era. So it seems to me that the justices kind of are trapped in a world where they just, and I say the justices, I don't mean all of them, they just keep thinking this magical thought that we could make it be, you know, the 1960s or 50s or 40s again, where they can, you know, go where they want, speak to whomever they want to, say whatever they want, and it won't get reported out. I think those days are over. So now there's a decision to be made, right? Either the court has to say we want to be seen as, you know, serious and different from the other branches, and we want to be afforded the respect that judges should get. But then I think you really do have to behave like a judge at all times, even though that will cramp your social style and probably, less book deals. But I think that that's the choice that needs to be made. But what's not going to work is to say we have one life that we conduct in public on the bench, and another life that we conduct in private when we go places and say things and do things, and the twain's never going to meet. They're not going to get matched up and then be reflected in how public opinion about the court plays out. So I think that's where we are right now. I don't think the media is ever going to change. I don't think the media is ever going to get to be more reflective and have more time to think. I don't think that the complete collapse of opinion and fact will ever be undone. So I think the media is what it is. And insofar as it's in a death spiral, you know, it sucks. But I think that's where we are with the media. So really the court has to accommodate the pressures that I think that the press puts on it. And I think that sort of locking the public out of audio and of video and of speeches is not an accommodation. I think it's, like I said, magical thinking. So what I want to leave you with is, if I'm right, that it's not just the way the court conducts itself with regard to the press, but it's also the way the court thinks about the media and talks about the media, then I think we really do have a problem. And I just want to sort of end by saying, a few short years ago, the court decided to lock the big ceremonial front doors of the building based almost completely on some inchoate sense that the justices are just not safe anymore. And I don't know objectively how you measure whether justices are safe or not, but I'm sure that when you hear Justice Ginsburg or Justice O'Connor talk about, you know, the amount of death threats and the amount of violent rhetoric directed towards them and their colleagues, I'm sure they don't feel safe anymore. I don't know if any of us feel safe anymore, but I'm not sure that's the metric by which you decide to lock the front door of the court. But for me, it's a sort of very worrisome symbol about where this relationship is going. So I'm going to end there. On that incredibly depressing note. And I'm happy to take questions about this or other things, or just to gossip, or to talk thoughtfully about long-form journalism. But thank you very much.